And.
Okay.
Wait, hold on, let me check the audio.
Many millions of years ago, a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings got so fed up at the constant bickering about the meaning of life that they commissioned two of their brightest and best to design and build a stupendous supercomputer to calculate the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Oh, DeepForge, we want you to tell us the answer.
And the answer to what?
The answer to life, the universe, everything. We'd really like an answer. Something simple.
We have to think about that. Return to this place in exactly 7.5 million years.
As a furnace, I don't know, there's more.
They go back.
Well, 7.5 million years later.
That's right, they do.
Yes, but you're not going to like it.
It doesn't matter. We must know it.
All right. The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is... to have known what the actual question was.
But it was the question. The ultimate question. Of everything.
That's not a question.
Okay. Well, it was a long time coming. 7.5 million years for the answer 42. But actually, I thought that something that Deep Thought said after giving that answer was really interesting. If you play on that a little bit more, she says, only when you know the question will you be able to know what the answer means. Now, Easter, if I can make this work, whoops. Easter is the event where Jesus, or part of Easter is the event that Jesus came back from the dead, and this is part of what Christians call revelation. Revelation just comes from the English word meaning to reveal. It's part of the conversation that God's having with us, trying to show who he is. Now, although it's part of the Christian revelation, it is for many people quite a baffling event. And so it's not a bad thing to think about. If the resurrection is supposed to be some kind of answer for humanity, what exactly is the question or the questions? There are a number of questions that Easter answers, but I'm just going to focus on three tonight. The resurrection specifically. The first question is, what does a good life look like? What does a fulfilling life look like? The second question is, why are relationships so important? Now, everybody, no matter what their worldview, unless they're mentally ill, believes that relationships are fundamental to life. But the question I'm asking is, why do people believe that? And the third question is whether there's any hope when things look hopeless. But I guess before I get onto those questions, especially if you're not someone who's a believer in any kind of religion or Christianity, it would be natural to ask the question, did the resurrection happen at all? Now, fortunately, because the resurrection is such a central part of the Christian worldview, it's actually, believe it or not, one of the best attested miracles in the whole Christian narrative. So over my time as a Christian, whenever I've heard talks on the resurrection or seen any films or anything on it, it's usually been with the purpose of either trying to persuade people who don't believe in the supernatural or believe in Christianity to believe it, or it's been to encourage people whose faith is wavering. One such story of how the resurrection led to someone changing their beliefs is a guy called Frank Morrison. He wrote a book called Who Moved the Stone? And he took on the resurrection as a kind of personal project, but it went incredibly bad. You know, like a university project of group work, which everybody starts arguing, well, this went bad in another way. It went bad because he started out with the aim of showing that the supernatural Jesus was ridiculous, and actually ended up believing in the supernatural Jesus because of the resurrection. Now, there are a number of things that I could point to here, and I'm glad we've got some dialogue afterwards so that we can explore that further, but I'll just mention a couple of things. The first is that Morrison and other people have been impressed by the way in which the accounts of the resurrection appear to be those of eyewitnesses. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to show you, I hope to show you. Oh, here we go. Here is part of the description of the resurrection in two different accounts in the scriptures. So the first one on the left-hand side is by a guy called Mark, and the one on the right-hand side is by a guy called Luke. Now, I'll just give you a couple of minutes to read those quickly. Okay, now, if you went to a football match or if you witnessed a crime and you were asked to write an account of it, chances are, if you were a reliable witness and there were several witnesses, that people would agree on the main details, but there would be minor differences that would be hard to reconcile. That's one of the features of eyewitness accounts. Now, as it turns out here, the main details are the same, but there are some annoying or differences. There are some differences which are hard to kind of work out. You notice in one account there's one angel referred to, and in the other account there's two angels referred to. There's another thing about these accounts, and sorry, this is exactly what you would expect from an eyewitness account. There's another thing which speaks about the truth or integrity of the people who wrote this, which we completely miss, and that's because of the culture we live in. The first witnesses to the resurrection, according to these accounts, were women. And in the sexist times in which this was written, I'm sad to say that a woman's testimony was not regarded in a court as reliable or as important as a man's testimony. So if you were making up a story, this would be a dumb thing to put in the story to make the first witnesses women. As I said, there are many, many things which commend the resurrection as historically credible. So let me just give you four things that scholars, really, whether they're Christians or not, all agree with and have a great deal of difficulty explaining if Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Here are the four facts. Jesus was actually dead. His tomb was empty. There are many reported appearances of Jesus. And the disciples were changed into people who were so courageous they could go around the Roman world and kind of conquer it for Christianity, completely unafraid of their own deaths. There is an excellent YouTube clip, which I'm happy to give you the link for, by William Lane Craig on all this. And if you want to Google it, just do William Lane Craig, Yale 2014. It's really, really carefully, logically laid out. I'd even go so far as to say that the resurrection makes sense scientifically. Now, in saying that, I have to be clear with you that I'm using the word scientific in a very broad sense to just mean the bringing of evidence and logic together to try and establish some kind of proposition. There are many things in Christianity that can't be discussed that way, I admit that, but the resurrection is not one of them. We have different accounts, we have theories to compare and contrast, we have the motives of the actors to weigh, just like we might if we're in a courtroom. And in fact, that's the metaphor that Morrison used when he was investigating the resurrection. He thought of himself as going around a courtroom. But I also want to use the word scientifically to make a contrast with how the new atheists like Richard Dawkins think about these issues. Ironically, the very people who castigate Christians for being unscientific are less than scientific themselves when it comes to discussing miracles. Let me explain this. When it comes to miracles, most new atheists are rational without being scientific. If you're convinced that something is crazy, you won't even look for evidence for it. But looking at evidence is actually part of what it means to be scientific. So, for example, if I told you there were fairies at the bottom of my garden, you wouldn't look because you wouldn't see any point. So strong is your starting prejudice against fairies. I hope you wouldn't look. Although I do admire Professor Dawkins for reading a lot of Christian material, I've yet to come across a good discussion of his on the resurrection. He has prejudged it as crazy, like fairies at the bottom of the garden, and doesn't take it seriously. Instead, in his recent book, The Magic of Reality, which is the God delusion for young children, he focuses on Jesus turning the water into wine. So there's a little parody of Jesus turning the water into wine, a rabbit, rabbits in hats and all sorts of stuff he's getting at there. Now, this is a miracle which, although I believe it, I fully admit that it doesn't lend itself to the close scrutiny that the resurrection does. So, sadly, I'm sad to say this, it's a sign of his lack of respect for evidence that he doesn't engage with the strongest evidence for Christianity. A good scientist who's concerned about truth looks for the strongest form of a position, not the weakest. Professor Dawkins can tell himself he's being rational because we all choose what we investigate, but I fear he's fooling himself if he thinks his approach to Christianity is scientific because he's not looking at the best evidence. By the way, the reason why you should examine the resurrection and not fairies at the bottom of the garden is that Christianity rests on high-quality historical documents. It commands the respect and belief of millions. It changes lives and societies. And it offers answers to deep life questions. I'm not saying that that's a reason for believing it. I'm saying that that's enough for you to investigate it. The stakes are high, in other words. High stakes make it worth investigating things. They're not the same as arguments for their truth, but they make it worth investigating things. But now I want to press on with the questions for which the resurrection is the answer. My first question is, what does a good life look like? I have a good friend who worked for a while in child protection. Now, this was a tragic job. I don't know how she did it. But she would go into family situations where children were being so badly mistreated that the government was thinking of taking them away. After a while of dealing with people with such troubling values, she said that she was losing her moral compass and she had to get out. So she left the job. Now, there's a sense in which any of us living in this society might feel as though we're losing our moral compass, because whatever you think about any moral issue, there are lots and lots of people who disagree with you, whatever it is that you think. As Paul Kelly put it in last week's edition of The Australian, quoting a British sociologist, "Conflicts over values have acquired enormous significance in political life. There is an absence of agreement on some of the most fundamental questions facing society." Now, in that article, he mentioned a bunch of social issues, particular red button issues that, you know, you would all know, and I don't need to tell you what they are. But I think that these issues, the kinds of issues that get bandied around in the newspapers, are not actually the most fundamental questions facing society. I think there are two other questions which are really fundamental. The first is, are humans fully and comprehensively just part of nature? I.e., do we have a special status or special responsibilities compared to animals? This is a fundamental question of which so many other questions come from. And the second question is related to it. Is there any outside reference point for understanding the ethical dimension of life? Or are we free to make it up as we go? This was the vision of someone like John Lennon when he wrote that song Imagine, which you might know, where there's nothing there beyond us and we can pursue our own lives as we see fit. Is that the situation or not? Well, Jesus' resurrection comes in here. Let me pick up one of Jesus' earliest followers, Paul. He was preaching in Athens. This was a bubbling cauldron of ideas, a bit like our society. In fact, Luke, Paul's biographer, says of his trip to Athens that all the Athenians and the foreigners who used to live there spend their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas, a bit like university. So Paul says this to the crowd. God commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed, that is to say, Jesus. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. So Jesus' resurrection assures us that there is a judgment coming and that the judge's credentials, namely Jesus, have been established by rising from the dead. Now, there's an implication of that. If there is a judge, if justice is meaningful, then it means there's some kind of pattern of human flourishing or some kind of standard of human life that we're held accountable to. We don't make this up ourselves. It's an external standard. So Jesus addresses our morally chaotic times much as he addressed a wild storm on the Sea of Galilee. For those of you who are Christians who know the story, he said, "Be still," and there was a great calm. So let me turn to the second question that Jesus' resurrection answers. Whoops. Okay, there we go. The second question is, why are relationships important? Now, as I said, there's one thing that everybody in life agrees with, and that is that relationships are centrally important. And this is relevant because the resurrection makes sense relationally. Sometimes people speak of the resurrection as though Jesus came back to life himself, and sometimes Christians even speak that way too. But this is not what Christianity actually says. It says that God the Father raised him in Acts 2:32. So the resurrection is one more instance of Jesus being part of a divine cooperative venture, a dance, if you like, which Christians have come to call the Trinity. Now, of all the ideas in Christianity, the Trinity, which is that God is three persons, is an extremely strange one, and I don't pretend to understand it. But note this, it does accord with the intuition that I just mentioned about the importance of relationships. You see, for an atheist, it seems to me, now, some of you may be atheists here and you can correct me afterwards. While a relationship can certainly enjoy relationships and say they're a central part of their life, it seems to me that ultimately impersonal science like physics and chemistry is the path to knowledge about the universe. Atheists could never say that relationships are somehow the key to understanding life, the universe, and everything. That seems to me to be a hard thing for them to say. That there, here in relationships, there lies an answer to the meaning of life even better than 42. See, in the clip, the supercomputer Deep Thought complains that it's unfair that people don't like her answer, 42, because there isn't really a question. But I think there is a question about relationships to answer. Yes, they're super important. Everybody believes that. But why do we attach such enormous significance to them? In an atheistic evolutionary account, relationships are grounded in nothing more than the need to reproduce and survive. A thinking atheist could easily pause and ask themselves the disturbing question, is the significance I attach to all my relationships simply an illusion? Now, for a Christian, that's not a problem. Part of the idea of the Trinity is that relationships are foundational, that gods existed in relationship even before the material creation. And this accords exactly with the widespread notion that relationships are the very stuff of life. So let me come to my last question, which is there hope in life when everything fails us? Now, it's well known that Christians believe in the existence after death. So a passage like 1 Corinthians 15, Jesus' resurrection and ours are tied together in the thinking of the person writing that passage, which is the Apostle Paul, with Jesus paving the way for those of us who trust him to follow into an afterlife. But there's also an important day-to-day dimension of hope which the resurrection brings. Let me read you something else from Paul. I'll put it up on the screen in a moment, as he describes a time of great trauma in his life. The details are sketchy. We don't actually understand what they are. But the impact on him is perfectly clear. Sometimes, those of us who are Christians and are familiar with the writings of this man Think that the guy who said, in everything give thanks, in 1 Thessalonians 5:18, or I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, in Philippians 4:13. We think he never lost it. He never gave up and completely lost it. But in this passage, I think he did. He describes a point in his life where he sunk into such terrible despair, but as he came out, he could see God performing a mini resurrection in his own experience. We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. In everything, give thanks, Paul? Indeed, we felt we had received the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on God, might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. Now, we live in a hope-starved world. When I think of the depth of hatred and grief in places like the Middle East, or even the political divisions in many Western countries now, it's easy to be overwhelmed. But actually, this can hardly be better than the situation at the end of World War II, and I've got a story to tell you. Oh, what's going on here? I've got a story to tell you about that. Corrie ten Boom was a woman who hid Jews in her house until she was discovered. She was then sent to a concentration camp. There she saw her sister beaten repeatedly. In fact, her sister ultimately died from the mistreatment. After the war finished and Europe was a wasteland, she decided that God wanted her to go to Germany and preach to people about forgiveness. Unfortunately for her, she went to speak at one church, and there in the audience was a guard, one of the guards who'd beaten her sister. And the guard then came up to her after the service. And I've, so that we can hear this in Corrie ten Boom's voice, I've got a woman to read it. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. My name is Caroline. And I'm third year as a student. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment I saw the overcoat and the brown hat, the next a blue uniform and a visored cap with its skull and crossbones. It came back with a rush, the huge room with its harsh overhead lights, the pile of pathetic dresses and shoes in the centre of the floor, the shame of walking naked past this man. Now he was in front of me, hands thrusted out, a fine message. Fraulein, how good is it to know that, as you say, all our sins are at the bottom of the sea? I stood there with the coldness clutching my heart, but forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Help! I prayed silently. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so, woodenly, mechanically, I thrusted my hand into the one that stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder and raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. Then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing it tears to my eyes. For a long moment, we grasped each other's hand, and the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so immensely as I did
then. Thank you very much, Carol. So, let me suggest that there are a few ways in which the resurrection can touch our lives, whoever we are. So if you're someone who doesn't have any belief in Christianity today, thank you very much for coming on behalf of Credo. It's great that you're here. Let me be clear about what's on offer, even if you think it's crazy. What's on offer is that there is a God who loves you and has visited us to make that love real. Now, you must agree, I think, that if this were true, it would be a very, very big truth. That's not the same thing as saying it is true, but if it were true, it would be a very, very big truth worth investigating. Now, Christianity is a large animal, and it can be hard to know where to start looking at it. But I'd like to suggest to you that if you're someone who has an evidential mindset, you like reasons for what you believe, then looking carefully at the resurrection is a great place to start, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions afterwards, either in the open time or speaking with me personally. Feel free to talk with anyone here or to talk with me, and we can certainly do some things to help you assess for yourself the remarkable claims of Christianity. If you're a Christian who's feeling very confused in the current environment about what pleases God, then I'd just encourage you to listen to the right person. So Jesus once said during his time here that whoever has seen me has seen the Father. And he responded to some of the most challenging times in his own life with sentences that began, "It is written." So God's Son and God's Word are the places for us to look for answers if we're Christians. And this was confirmed when Jesus was raised from the dead, as Paul said. Finally, if you're losing or have lost hope in life, can I encourage you to rely on God who raises the dead? Among a relatively young and perhaps even privileged group like this, it might seem that death is a stranger. But I doubt that this is so. Some of you will have faced or are facing direct bereavement, and I'd be very happy to talk to any Christians who've lost someone who isn't a Christian. But there are other deaths too. Prolonged sickness, an alarming medical prognosis, the death of a friendship, the death of a romance. Sin that's made you think differently about yourself, or a failure in some area that was really important to you, or a crippled faith. Whatever it is, the more hopeless it seems, the more God will be glorified when he meets you and raises the dead. Let me wrap up here. It seems that Deep Thought's problem was that he couldn't think of a question, It seems that Deep Thought couldn't think of a question for which her answer fitted. But when it comes to the resurrection, there are actually an abundance of questions that do fit. And I suppose if we were to string them all together for a total understanding, it would take 7.5 million years at least. So we'd like you to come back in 7.5 million years, but I have to say that we are having some troubles with the university administration about a room booking. So when we resolve that, we'll contact you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Gordon. There's a chance for us to... Gordon's happy to take some questions, is
yeah,
that
yeah.
right?
Yep.
So maybe just give him a chance to catch his breath, have a drink.
That's all right, I'm
feel
okay.
Feel free to turn to the people next to you, or maybe you might just want to sort of quietly compose your thoughts, maybe share things that struck you, things that confused you, questions you might have. So just do that for a few minutes. If you're not comfortable asking a question up front, there's talkback forms on your table, which you can write them down, and Gordon will get back to you in the next couple of days. But for now, just talk to friends, people around you, and then we'll have some questions in a minute.
I don't know what happened.
Oh, it's just been a while. All good. Okay. Mm-hmm.